Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Lawrence Hildes for Plaintiffs Appellants Gregory Lewis and Leith Yanowski Call. I apologize. I usually get his name right. Both of whom are present in the courtroom this morning.
Thank you.
The major two issues for appellants are the finding of res judicata below as to Mr. Dorsey and the finding that the district is not liable based on Mr. Dorsey not being the decision maker, the policy maker. We think that the decision below was odd. to say the least, there is no case law that requires that you do an administrative appeal and a civil action at the same time on a civil rights issue.
Well, the question isn't whether it's required in the sense of Washington law. The question is whether it's permitted under Washington law for you to do that. Because if it's permitted, I think under Washington law, then you should have done it.
Well, the appeal, the statute for appeal on to Superior Court was very specific that it was, this is the means of appeal. This is how you properly follow the rules, is to appeal from the decision of the school board or the school district to Superior Court. And that's an administrative appeal. You don't combine an administrative appeal with an affirmative civil action. It's different from combining the cases that defendants used, combining a challenge to a will with an action against the administrator, et cetera.
Anything under Washington law that would have precluded your pursuing this First Amendment damages claim?
Yes.
And where would we look in Washington law to find that?
Well, we couldn't have pursued the concurrent state claims. To file an action with state torts, you have to do a tort claim, which requires 60 days. And to appeal the administrative decision, you have to file within 30 days. And it is pretty standard to exhaust your remedies. There's requirements generally in civil rights law that you exhaust your administrative remedies unless there's an absolute urgency not to do so.
But you had, I thought, I mean, just correct me if I'm wrong, you've got your administrative requirement, as you call it, with respect to the administrative appeal, and then you have your 60-day. But didn't you have 6 months? Wasn't there a six-month period intervening there in which you could have, if it were true that you needed to do a state exhaustion, you'd still have time to file in that proceeding?
But there wasn't, we didn't have the resolution yet to sue based on. We needed a finding.
Why did you need a finding? I mean, there's two ways to look at it, so maybe you can. One way to look at it is you waited to see what the answer was, then you went to federal court. Another way to look at it is, as you're saying, I wanted to know the answer so I would know what to do. But either way, you still had leeway there to file within the state court, didn't you? Even after you got the answer, so to speak?
That wasn't obvious to me as a matter of law. And they're actually the only case that even says you can bring it concurrently is Judge Kunauer's district opinion, which was not published, and I don't know where the district found it. I could not find it, even after they cited it, for a very long time. So there was no notice out there that you even could do this. And the only case that ever cites it is a case out of Arizona that says that has nothing to do with the ability to bring the action. It simply says that the Individuals with Disability and Education Act applies to certain circumstances. So there is absolutely no case law out there that says that you can bring the civil action concurrently. I do a lot of employment law where you always have to exhaust your remedies. You go to the EEOC or the state human rights commission, depending on the issue, and you have to do that first.
Couldn't you have filed them both, the federal action and the state appeal at the same time, and asked the federal court to stay its proceedings pending your exhaustion of your administrative remedies? What prevented you from doing that?
We believed we needed a ruling out of the court to bring the action. Otherwise, I think it would have been dismissed as premature.
Can you explain that? I'm a little befuddled as to why you couldn't even just go straight to federal court. Why did you need the finding, as you put it? What's the legal predicate for that?
Because all we had at that point was an internal school district finding. Mm-hmm. They refer specifically to this RCW that gives the only avenue to be the state appeal to Superior Court. I didn't want to bring the action in Superior. If you bring two actions at the same time, they often will not stay one. I think we were inviting a 12B6, which we would have gotten immediately, saying that there was a finding in their favor, and I think we would have lost out of federal court. It's a different situation than the case from Judge Kuhnauer, that was very specific to disability law, to the IDEA, to the Rehabilitation Act, where that created a situation where you had immediate access to federal court.
But you had some pretty good facts.
I think we have great facts.
Yeah.
But I don't think...
The same person saying that you were not in compliance and then upholding his own decision, and then this injunction that said your clients couldn't even come to school board meetings, let alone not reenter the premises. Pretty good facts for a 1983.
I agree. But we also had a decision finding against us, and given that we had ample time under the statute of limitations, I thought it appropriate to check all the boxes and dot all the I's and cross the T's and do the process that was mandated by the statute.
Okay, so you pursued that course and you went to state court and you won.
Right, and then we immediately filed a claim and we filed a federal action.
You recover fees?
No.
Costs?
Nothing.
Did you ask for them?
No. I had expected that we would do that in the civil action.
Okay.
Do you have your claim that you needed the 30-day tort exhaustion? Is that in your brief?
Yes.
And what's the argument there? I'm looking at your brief now. So it
is on page 5.
Not in your res judicata argument.
It's in our facts. I think it is also in our res judicata argument.
Maybe that's what I see that you say you filed a tort claim. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
That's all it says is plaintiffs then filed a tort claim followed by the instant 1983.
I am then looking at section 1. I'm sorry.
Yeah, where would I look for the statutory cite on that?
Section 1, pages 15 and 16 and 17.
You You're talking about the 28-645-010.010?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is that the tort claim
section? That is the appeal.
That's the appeal from the administrative determination.
Yeah, I don't know if I have the...
I mean, I'm just telling you that you're making this argument now, and it's a new argument to
It's in my summary judgment response, Your Honor.
It might be in your summary judgment response, but you don't raise it in your brief, and so it's a new argument. I'm hearing it, but I'm, like, pecking through everything and trying to find it, and I'm not seeing it, that's all, and I'll go back and reread it. But
I thought we...
Not quite on notice when you say plaintiffs then filed a tort claim under 1983. That doesn't quite make the link, so that's why I'm asking the question. But I'll go back and... And I'm reading pages 15 to 17 of Section 1.
Yeah, I thought that we had...
So let me just get the chronology straight again, and this intersects with some of the earlier questions you've gotten from the panel. You had the 30-day and the 60-day Washington administrative appeal deadlines, and you could run those concurrently, could you not?
I believed, and I still believe that we had to wait for the appeal to be resolved, to exhaust the remedies. We do the same thing, you know, as with police misconduct cases often, where there is a police review commission. We will go through the police review commission and that administrative remedy first, unless it's completely futile. And I had no reason to believe that this appeal would be futile. And as I said in checking, I could not find a single case that allowed you to bring both at the same time. There's case law on bringing a land use case. There's case law on bringing an injunctive action and the damage claims at the same time, absolutely. But other than this one district court interlocutory ruling where there was no appellate procedure at all, and that was not a case that was discernible, apparently, unless you had Westlaw or Lexis. I think Westlaw, and I didn't. In looking at the law, when we got ready to file the appeal...
You didn't have access to library, Westlaw, and Lexis?
I could have... That's true. I could have done it, but I went through the resources that the bar makes available, which are very extensive, mm-hmm. and there was no case law requiring you or even inviting you or allowing you to file an administrative appeal and a damage case at the same time.
So let me go back then. You said there's not a single case that allowed you to bring both. Did you find anything that would not permit you to bring both? Or is it kind of a wash on both sides?
I think it's a wash on both sides. The issue wasn't there. It didn't come up. And I don't think our clients should be penalized for following the rules, for following the procedure that the statute lays out. And if we had filed a civil action and the appeal on the same issues in two different courts, we'd have the same res judicata issue. Whichever one decided first, we would have been in the same position we're in now if that's a live issue, because we brought the issues, and then we would have had an argument that we brought the issues in two different cases when we shouldn't have.
Do you want to reserve the remaining
time? I do, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the Court and Counsel, Stu Estes for appellees. The res judicata issue I'll address quickly first, but this court and many others, all others, have upheld res judicata, enforced res judicata in a variety of cases that underlie that. And that involves contract disputes, actions in equity, mandamus, declaratory judgment actions. There's a case where a constitutional issue was not raised in a misdemeanor, state court misdemeanor prosecution, and that was part.
Do you have any Washington state case law where there's an administrative appeal to the Superior Court in which there is then a later suit brought, say, 1983 or some other cause of action arising out of the same circumstances, where in the second suit in Washington state court, the second court says res judicata?
It's an essential principle that all administrative actions...
No, I'm asking, do you have a case?
If it's an appeal under 28A, I no. Mm-hmm. We have case law that says that counsel referred to the Kanaongata case that was Judge Kunauer's.
Sure.
However, we also cited another case, Clark versus Central Kitsap School District, where they were combined in the same action. So our position is that there is no barrier to combining an administrative appeal with an action for damages. And I know this court has heard over the years the LUPA or the Land Use Petition Act cases that are combined. That's a 21-day statute, and those are combined with Section 1983 cases all the time. And there are, on occasion, district court cases that have held that an adverse decision in the LUPA, which had to be filed within 3 weeks, can bar later Section 1983 claims.
Would you address his argument that it's a different thing to say a contract claim and a constitutional claim, but here you had two administrative exhaustion requirements. You had a tort requirement, and then you had the administrative appeal with the board, which was the essence of his main complaint.
Yes, Your Honor, neither of those state statutes are an impediment to a Section 1983 claim. There's no exhaustion under Section 1983, nor can I enforce the failure to file a tort claim in a Section 1983 claim. It's been preempted under the Supremacy Clause. So there's no barrier to just going straight to federal court with this claim. As soon as Mr. Dorsey issued the letter, that's what they could have and should have done. And
he could have filed it in state court, though, also, right? There's a
exactly
parallel jurisdiction.
No,
there.
Let me pick up on that. You said he should have gone to federal court?
He said he wants to go to federal court. And I'm saying that as soon as Mr. Dorsey issued that letter that they're challenging, he could have gone straight to federal court if that's what his.
But what about the point that Mr. Pildes made at the end, that if he's got a suit going under 1983 in federal court and he's got his administrative appeal in state superior court, if the state superior court decides that case first, I think it's going to be res judicata in federal court based on the argument you're making, if I agree with that argument. So why should he have gone straight to federal court? Why is that going to help him?
Because that's his that's what he's saying his choice is. He wanted to go to federal court. He could have gone to state court, too, in the Clark versus Central Kitsap.
No, maybe you're not taking my point. If he had gone to federal court, as you're saying he should have gone, and had he taken his administrative appeal to the state superior court, as I think he was required to do for that administrative appeal, if that administrative appeal had been decided by the superior court, his federal suit's gone under res judicata, as you would interpret the res judicata rule. So I'm not sure your advice that he should have gone to federal court is very good.
Under the Kanaongata case, and Judge Kunauer decided that administrative appeal in that case.
Oh, I see. He wanted to go. You say he could have gone to federal district court with the administrative appeal.
The whole shooting match.
I see what you're saying. Okay.
Right.
I got it.
So he could have either been in federal court for everything or state court for everything under your view.
And there's nothing in Washington law that requires that the administrative appeal go to superior court rather than federal district court.
It would be supplemental jurisdiction. That's how I interpret Judge Kunauer's decision.
I got it. Okay. I got it.
And so then we have all these other actions, and then we have administrative decisions under land use, like zoning board decisions, employment decisions. This is all in the res judicata context, and those are cases where, as we know, land use actions and employment appeals, mostly those are 30-day actions that have to be taken quite quickly. And the courts in this court have all upheld collateral estoppel and res judicata in those cases where the person appealed the decision, and whether it was adverse or to their benefit, like here. And in the Feminist Women's Health Clinic versus Cotispati case, That case, there was an abortion clinic that was that sued the protesters who had started fires and was blocking access to their patients, and they sued in federal court, obtained an injunction, and then came back with a RICO claim, which was tried to a jury in a very favorable jury verdict in front of Judge Zille, and this court said that was res judicata. That action for damages under RICO should have been combined with the injunction claim. So there are any number of...
Yeah, although that one seems like fairly straightforward res judicata. I mean, you're in federal court on two separate claims. It's not an administrative appeal arising out of state law. I mean, Judge Zille viewed that case as determinative for this one, but they do seem somewhat different to me.
Well, Your Honor, there the issues were the same because it all arose out of the same nucleus of facts. There's different cause of action, but this court said that's not dispositive. You can label something a different claim, but it's all arose out of the same issues, and that's why Judge Zille, we submitted the transcript of the appeal that they argued below and the brief, and Judge Zille found the appeal and another document and went through it all, and then under colloquy, Mr. Hildes admitted that they're all the same issues. The First Amendment claim was raised. He talked about the tenancy in there. It was all based on the same set of facts. And so everything could have been raised in the Superior Court or it could have been taken directly to federal court. And so I think that it might have been, if that's the only requirement for res judicata to apply, that the claim might have been brought.
Could he have sought damages in state court?
Under Section 1983?
No, in state court.
He could have filed a Section 1983 claim as well. We have concurrent jurisdiction over Section 1983 claims, Washington. And so I think that everything that would have been raised in this court or the trial court could have been and then should have been raised in the state superior court. So there's no impediment to that. The only thing he talks about is a 60-day tort claim waiting period, which he could have easily amended to add state law claims.
How about fees?
Fees would have been available under Section 1983 in state court. There's not a fee provision under the appeal statute. It's just a quick determination of whatever action is taken by the agency, the school district. It's specific to a school district. And so there has been no barrier whatsoever. The courts have, in res judicata cases, considered an argument. More typically, the argument is that this imposes an exhaustion requirement. And the courts say, there's no exhaustion requirement here. You didn't have to do it. You chose to do it, and once you choose to take that initial action, there's a consequence to it. So once you sue my client has the right to have all those actions decided in an initial case, so we don't get piecemeal litigation. And it could have and should have been raised in that action.
When the district decided to not only seek their removal from the premises, but to bar them from attending public defense events, was that done on the advice of counsel?
Mr. Boy, who was an assistant attorney with the district, was with the with Mr. Dorsey at the appeal hearing. That's really all the record speaks to.
Okay, so we don't know.
And there's nothing in the record to suggest that.
Thank you.
You know, when a question is asked what happened, and when the lawyer says there's nothing in the record, that sometimes suggests to me that there's knowledge that you have that's not in the record.
I'm assuming Mr. Boy was involved. What we do know is that the general counsel was not involved. That's what's in the record. Mr. English, they have a history with him, and their argument is that I know he was involved. He's always involved, but there's no testimony that they ever saw him at a meeting, that he ever sent a letter, that he was involved at all. So the record says that the general counsel was, but I'm assuming and I'm hoping that the assistant general counsel was involved in this. So just to round out the res judicata action or issue, there's two cases from the Ninth Circuit, Sewer Alert versus Pierce County and Takahashi, that both have actions that were initial actions that were enforced as far as res judicata. And in Sewer Alert, there was an action that was filed within 60 days of the wrongful conduct. And in Takahashi, the appeal of termination of a teacher was taken within 28 days of that action. And this court enforced res judicata on those claims as well. And as I indicated, LUPA cases have to be, the Land Use Petition Act cases have to be filed within 21 days. So it's a quick turnaround. It's the U.S. Supreme Court in MIGRA has said that collateral estoppel and res judicata apply in Section 1983 cases, and all the federal courts have said that it's that can be enforced in Section 1983 cases, even if they were filed quickly. A couple procedural issues. The ratification issue was thrown out at us at the first time an oral argument on the summary judgment. I don't think it's properly before the court. If it is going to be considered, the only thing of record is that Mr. Dorsey, we submitted an organizational chart. Mr. Dorsey is one of 45 mid-level managers, and so he's certainly not a final policymaker. There's nothing in the record that says the school board was involved at all. The superintendent's only action was to send a letter to the chief of police asking for the people to be removed, and that was an independent decision brought, investigated independently with advice of the city attorney for Seattle, and the Seattle Police Department went in there after finding indications of threats, of voicemail to a local TV station that there's a man on the roof at Horace Mann that's got an itchy trigger finger, and that we're going to set the charges and things like that. And so this was an action taken by the Seattle Police Department completely independent of the school district. The fact that a property owner asked the police to get someone out of their building that's not a tenant doesn't mean that they're liable for whatever action it is independently taken. And in Arnold versus IBM, this court said that the question isn't but for, certainly but for the request by the landowner to have the people removed, that wouldn't have been taken. However, the question is control. And in Arnold versus IBM, IBM was investigating someone who was stealing trade secrets. Their lawyers supplied all the witnesses. They flew the FBI agents around the West in an airplane, private jet. They gave cash for a buy operation and did other things. And this court said that certainly but for those actions, Mr. Arnold wouldn't have been arrested. But the question is whether IBM controlled that investigation and that the decision to make charges. And there's no indication here other than the superintendent asked the chief of police to remove them. And I think the record is crystal clear that they were not tenants. Everyone was out of that building in August. These people didn't have any connection to the Seattle Amistad. That tenant had moved out, and their position is, it is, you state it right in the brief, the community agreed that we would take over that subtenancy. Well, the master lease says there's only one way to do that, and that's with a written consent from the school district. And that master lease had been terminated in June. There was an occupancy agreement, which clearly said this is not a lease, and that lasted till August. And so there was no basis for them to be in that building. And just to quickly address the First Amendment question, we believe that qualified immunity, which was argued below, forms an alternative basis to affirm. Counsel indicates that we didn't cross appeal, but in Bacon versus Bloom, the Supreme Court said that the appellee may rely upon any matter appearing in the record in support of the judgment below. And that was argued and briefed. And so the particular right at issue under the clearly established rule, clearly established right principle, is that this is not someone who's kicked out of school board meetings for disruption. I mean, that we had that lawsuit previously, and that's in the record, where there was threats made directly to the school board members by one of the people who was in this building. But that's not this case. This case is that someone who has engaged in misconduct other than at a meeting, whether they can be...
Basically, it boils down to whether you can cut off their First Amendment rights because they did, in your view, a bad thing here, and now we're going to cut off their First Amendment rights over there.
Well, as the Third, Fourth, and Seventh Circuits have said, that it's not clear. And in the Workowitz case, which we cited, the court said this seems to be the retaliation for speech seems to be very distinct from the case there, which was someone who was banned from all property. And the court referred to it as a generalized facilities ban. And so in Lauburn, Vincent versus City of Sulphur, Workowitz, and then Barna, those are all cases cited in our brief, those all talk about how this right wasn't clearly established. And then I think Workowitz is even, or Barna is 2017, so well after this case, they're saying the right is still not clearly established. Whether they, a court or two is held, I don't think that's constitutional, but the courts of appeal are at odds with each other. And, not, and there's even the Lovren case, it's a Fourth Circuit case, when someone was banned from all property for misconduct, for alleging misconduct in the school, that lawsuit was frivolous. And so there's cases that go both ways that I'm not retaliating against you. I'm just saying you committed criminal acts in my building, one or two of you for the second time, this is the second occupation. So we just, for and now we have these threats of people with guns and charges going to be set. We think it's just safe for all the school district and for all the schools for you folks to stay out of these buildings. And so it didn't even address the speech issue. That was modified by Judge Prochnow only as to those meetings. I see my
thank you.
Red light's blinking.
Would you put a minute on the clock, please, so it's a full minute for rebuttal? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Your Honor, I found the reference in the brief to the 30-day rule. It is on page 20. It's the Hansen case and the discussion within the citation of that case is the top half of page 20. So, again, there was no reason for our clients. It's not clear to me that they could have brought the action separately. We would have run into the same problem. And you can't bring an appeal. At least there was no provision in state court for bringing an affirmative action with the appeal. This is a statute that specifically requires the appeal. And all of the cases that appellees cite are they're not administrative appeals, except for land use. Land use is its own area of law. But the reproductive rights case is a clearer one. It's an injunctive action and then a separate civil action. Clearly, those should have been brought together. There is no case law. Under the scenario that the appellees, the defense wants, they can make outrageous rulings, and there's no way to challenge those rulings without jumping through every hoop at the same time. You should not be penalized for following the rules. And the First Amendment issues, if I may, some person supposedly called a TV station and said, I have an itchy trigger finger. There's no evidence that that happened. There's no evidence of who that person is. But our clients are supposed to be banned, not from the building where they did the occupation, but from every district proceeding. These are education rights activists, and the district is telling them to shut up for a year, that they cannot be heard, that they cannot attend school board meetings because somebody else may have done something. It goes to the issues in Collins v. Jordan. It goes to Ibarra on group liability, and it's fundamentally unfair. This is a fundamental injustice. Our clients are entitled to have their damages. And by the way, the issues before the court below were not the same issues. Yes, there's a First Amendment claim that's common in banning them from the district. But we didn't ask the Superior Court, and the Superior Court was not in a position to rule on the tenancy, was not in a position to rule on the arrest. It was a very narrowly mandated appeal from the district. And by the way, the transcript of the district, of the hearing that Dorsey conducted on behalf of the district, Mr. Boy is sitting next to him as counsel for the district, reminding him that his duty is to the district. It's in the transcript for that hearing, which we attached.
And we have the transcript and the other records. I appreciate your argument this morning. The case of Lewis versus English is submitted. Thank both counsel for your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.